Welcome to EIR Talks. On September 1st, in the midst of a rapidly accelerating financial collapse, and just 10 days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, Lyndon LaRouche delivered a powerful speech addressing the need to develop new, serious leadership in the United States in order to confront the multiple overlapping crises facing our nation. LaRouche spoke in Reston, Virginia, to a local audience of nearly 1,000 supporters, and to an international audience via live webcast. This week, EIR Talks brings you excerpts from LaRouche's speech, which was entitled, "You Have Nothing to Fear So Much as Denial Itself." Here's Lyndon LaRouche.
On January 3rd of this year, I conducted an international webcast in which I said the following two paragraphs, quoting my own words from that period. I said then, the problem today is that from everything you can see about this team, not only Mr. Bush, but the entire team, what he said about this policy, that the incoming president promises to be the greatest catastrophe in American presidential history, not some years down the line, but in the next weeks and months immediately ahead. The problem which I shall outline today, as I said then, and also indicate what my role in this business is that we are not only in the worst financial crisis in modern history, the biggest one, we're also in globally a potential global economic breakdown crisis that is something qualitatively worse than a depression. If the Bush team occupies the presidency, I said on January 3rd, and sticks to its policies, which it has stated it is firmly committed to, the United States will be very soon destroyed as a nation, not years down the line, but perhaps in a very short period of time to come. Now, therefore, let's have some fun. What I promised you, in effect, and January 3rd of this year is now happening. No one can stop it as long as this present system exists. It's doomed. No one can fix it. There is no recovery from it. The system is finished. The question is, can we kill the system in time to save the nations and the economy? No other question. Let's have some fun. Now, I often say, let's have some fun, largely because of a reaction to the fact that in my life's experience, which is not inconsiderable, it could be bigger, but it's not inconsiderable, that I've met a great number of people who've come out of universities, for example, and have learned very much, but who know virtually nothing, because they never really had any fun. They learned. They were too busy learning to have fun. Now, what's fun? Fun, as described by Friedrich Schiller and others, is what a happy puppy does, what a happy young horse does. They have fun. They play. If you have a pet, the pet wishes to play. If you don't play with the pet is unhappy. How do you train a horse? You play with it. The horse likes to play. And you play a game with a horse that the horse likes. The horse accepts your leadership as a human being in playing. That's how you deal with animals. It's how you raise cattle. It's how you raise sheep. You play with them. Because playing is the highest quality of character of an animal. And domesticated animals are those which have become accustomed not merely to being handled by people, but being playing with people. Now, human beings are somewhat different than animals. Don't let the case of George Bush fool you. Human beings have a higher form of play, which we call cognition. Cognition is elementary. It means that we're faced with problems which contradict what we have believed. We face a problem, and the evidence is that what we've believed is not true. Or it was sometimes true, but then again, sometimes it was not. These are called paradoxes, contradictions in life. In science, in what you do is you face these contradictions and you have fun with them. You play with them. You develop an insight into a possible solution of principle for this contradiction, this paradox, that everything you believed is now called into question, and you have to find the solution. You have to find the key that opens the door to the solution. And you think you have a solution, and you conduct tests, experiments, discover if your discovery is true. This is called science. Now, when you study the work of great minds of the past, discoveries of principle, and I've often used the example of Archimedes as an example of this, that a child in a secondary school should be able to reproduce the act of discovery of scientific principles made, several of them, by Archimedes. So the child, therefore, is not merely experiencing learning, the child is replicating what happened inside the mind of Archimedes. Therefore, the child has a memory of what, not what Archimedes said, but a memory of the act of thinking by Archimedes. And those of us who know anything know it only because we have come to know it in that way. We have played. We have faced contradictions. We have distrusted pat formulas. We don't believe in textbooks. We don't believe what the press says. We don't believe what everybody says is true. We know it's wrong. If everybody says it's true, it has to be wrong. If the neighbors all say and agree, it's wrong. Now that's scientific thinking, and it's also play. It's responsible human play, unlike the play of the animal, but related to that. And you come out of a university laughing happily because you have made discoveries which you enjoy. You now know something about the inside of the mind of Archimedes. You know something about the inside of the mind of great artists, great poets, great scientists. Therefore, memory of what they thought, not the words they said, but the actual act of thinking by a living human being 2,000 years or more ago lives in your mind, as if that person were a living person inside your mind in that degree. Right? So that whenever we face a great crisis, we say, thank God, at last, we needed this. Because we had to be confronted with a paradox where everything that most people believed is wrong and the evidence is presented. That means we are being challenged to discover the truth. And only the truth will save us. And we have to think, be happy. We have to play. We have to have fun. We have to know. We have to create. And such is the situation now. People say, well, what about my money? Your money's gone, buddy. Look at it. Kiss it goodbye if you like it that much. It's gone. Now I'll get into that. But the point is, approaching the subject which I'm presenting today, have fun. Don't be depressed. Now Franklin Roosevelt said, as he was coming into the presidency, in the middle of the Depression, he said to the American people something that was very useful, very proper. We have nothing as much to fear as fear itself. Fear of this horrible thing which is descending upon us is the thing we have to fear the most. We have to laugh at this depression and say we're going to lick it. We have to laugh at this crisis and say we're going to overcome it. And we will take the attitude of having fun in confronting this devil now before us. We'll enjoy the process and we'll win. If we don't have fun, if we go to the school books, if we go to the press and say, well, I got to learn what this is all about. I've got to go to school and study the textbooks. I've got to see the professors. Well, I said, don't bother going to these economics professors. They're the one that created this mess. What do you want to go to them for? I mean, you don't get rid of syphilis by going back to the prostitute that gave it to you. So therefore, let's have some fun. Now, what I'm going to do is to address three essential audiences, as I did at an earlier event in a transatlantic satellite conference with the public accountants of Mexico, and as I did recently at Bad Schwalbach in Germany, at Oberwesel in Germany, on the same theme. We have three groups of people to address. One, we have people who are in professional experts and so forth, who may not always have the right opinion, but they have an understanding of some of the essential facts of the matter and can conduct an intelligent, rational discussion of some of these problems. Now, I have some very definite solutions for this crisis. They are complete in principle, but they are not complete in detail. So it would be the obvious thing in the world for me to meet with people who have these qualifications and for us to discuss these matters and to thrash out some of the details which must be discussed. Then we go to a second audience together, the audience of the politicians who really don't know anything, but they are in government and they're going to have to make decisions. We must educate them. Therefore, we must recruit a kind of Gideon's army of the experts to go in and educate the idiots, the congressmen, and the president. I don't know if he's educable or not, but anyway. Then we have a third level of population, the citizens in general, especially younger people who are the spark plug of any recovery. They're the ones who will kick their parents and others into moving. People, you know, when they get to the age, unlike me, when they get to the age of 40, they decide to become old. That's crazy. Why should you become old? You say, I'm slowing down a bit. I can do less physical activity, so I'll do some more mental activity instead. But young people tend to spark old people who've become a little bit stodgy into getting some courage to go ahead and do something good. So we have to address the general citizens, these three layers. We must very quickly bring about a change in the way the population and institutions think about the world, and the way they make policy in the world, and the way they act right now. It's the only thing that's going to save this human race. And those of us who understand this have to take the lead in doing it. Now, let's take first the history of the United States economy and the world economy since about the time of the death of Roosevelt. Before Roosevelt died, during the years 1942-1945 as president, he repeatedly told people, including one famous confrontation with British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. He said, Winston! And Winston was nervous. He knew something was coming. We are not going to put up, when this war is ended, with your British 18th century methods. We are not going to put up with your colonial system anymore. When this war is ended, we're going to end colonialization, and we're going to build these former colonies into genuine countries, standing on their own feet, and we're going to help them develop. And we are going to eliminate from this planet the rule of the economic affairs among nations by your British 18th century methods, that is the methods of Adam Smith or free trade. Now, Roosevelt did a number of other things besides resolve on that intention. He also designed, not Keynes, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his collaborators, designed what became known as the Bretton Woods system. At Bretton Woods in New Hampshire, a state which I come from, right under Mount Washington, the highest peak in New Hampshire and the coldest place in North America come the depths of any winter. It's only about 6,000 feet high, a little over that, but it's the coldest place in North America. From the Arctic, the winds come sweeping down with nothing in their way, and they hit this obstacle, and it is cold.
So that's where I come from. But Roosevelt, at the underneath the eaves of Mount Washington, in a place called the Bretton Woods, famous for the Bretton Woods Hotel of that period, convened an international conference to set into motion a post-war system. That is a financial and monetary system with economic intentions intended to rebuild a shattered, war-torn world, shattered by a depression and war. But then he died. And before his dead body had cooled off, Truman had sold out. Truman and company had immediately authorized and collaborated with the British in sending in British, Dutch, French, Japanese, and other troops to restore colonial power to areas which had been in the process of freeing themselves during the period of the war. So what came out was not good. Truman was not a good man. He was president, but he was not a good man. We've had a lot of bum presidents, you know, in the United States. It's a good country, but bum presidents. And some dumb voters, too, to go match them. So what happened is we got from 1945 on, we entered into collaboration with the nations of Western Europe and with Japan in short order under MacArthur's occupation, and to some degree with the countries of Central and South America in a system which became known as the Bretton Woods system, the old IMF system. It was a system which was based on fixed exchange rates on a gold reserve denominated system, of the kind of thing that the Russian government is talking about launching now. So don't say a gold reserve system is dead. If you know anything about gold systems, gold reserve systems are on the make right now. Look in your pocket for gold. That continued, that progress continued through collaboration, especially with Europe and Japan, and past the death and assassination of John F. Kennedy, with ups and downs and faults all in between, and evils and abuses and whatnot. But nonetheless, under the Bretton Woods system, the condition of life of the average person in these countries improved. The productive powers of labor increased. The standard of living on the average improved. Things were moving up, with all the shortcomings, shortfalls, and errors involved. Then came the middle of the 1960s. 1966, fascism came back to America in the form of the Richard Nixon campaign, which is the 1966-1968 Southern strategy, which is love your fellow Klansmen. That's what it was. So you had a group of New York bankers, Southern Confederate types like the teacher, professor of Henry Kissinger, Elliot, William Yandel Elliot, one of the Nashville agrarians. These are racists, pure racists, the pure Confederates, pure traitors at heart. And also some of these Southern religious types who don't believe in Christ or in God. They believe in money and they believe in magic. That if the Battle of Armageddon would come tomorrow, they'd get raptured and wouldn't have to pay next month's rent. That's their religion. So this crowd took over. Different assumptions were made. 1971, a new monetary system was put in under Nixon, took down the gold reserve system, set up a floating exchange rate, and the world has been going systematically to hell ever since. So we have two systems over the period 1945 to the present. One system which all its faults worked, and another system which has been a disaster from the onset, from the get-go, as they say, which is the present system. So the problem we have is not a depression, it's not a recession, it's not a system in which there are collapses and recoveries, it's a system from which you do not recover. The only way you recover is to get rid of the system. Think of it like cancer. The way you survive cancer is to get rid of it, not to learn to live with it. You see the problems today the changes in the following way. In 1968, we had the Southern Strategy, which won the 68 election and brought Nixon into the White House. Racism triumphed. I could tell you a lot about how racism triumphed. Black nationalism was used to destroy the civil rights movement. It happened in Selma also, where some boys were bought out. And they went to work to split the civil rights movement, and it was never able to get the momentum it had earlier after that period. Because people, New York bankers and others, moved in and said, we're going to have to split this country, we're going to have to restore racism in this country. Because this thing that's been done with the Kennedys and with Martin Luther King is something we've got to stop. And that was part of the impetus. Remember George Wallace? How George Wallace helped to elect Richard Nixon? Because what George Wallace did was lead the parade of the Southern Democrat, racist, pro-racist Southern Democrats out of the Democratic Party in the direction of the Republican Party. And what you have today is a Republican Party which is composed of New York bankers, market bankers, they're not real bankers, they're thieves. You have people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, who were not really sane. And you have then these guys who were these traditional Southern racists, who were all over government, judges, and so forth. That was the first change. Next change came with after 71, it came with the Carter administration, which was the Southern Strategy Democratic Party version. In other words, the Republican Party became dominated under the Nixon administration by racists. The Carter election, was a takeover of the Democratic Party to where the racists had a dominant position. It was what the Democratic Party did, in effect, was say, we're going to defend the Democratic Party by keeping those who are pro-racist in the party to vote and to vote for our candidates. And therefore, we picked a dummy, Jimmy Carter, who didn't know what he was doing, mental case, had a mental breakdown, that's what qualified him to become governor in Georgia. See, the kind of man they could trust. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's also crazy and dangerously so, and David Rockefeller, took this dummy, Governor Jimmy Carter, paid him a lot of money, and made him president. And the way it worked is the Democrats argued, we have to keep the racists in the Democratic Party to keep them from running over to the Republican Party, and then the Republican Party would run the nation. So you had a program that was developed by the New York bankers called the Project 1980s, and this program, which was headed up by Brzezinski, actually ran the Carter administration, and Paul Volcker came in to put the knife in the back of the U.S. economy in 1979. That was one phase. We went downhill right after that. Carter did more damage as president to the U.S. economy than any president in the 20th century, any other president. He was the worst president we ever had for the economy. And that's how Ronald Reagan got elected, because Carter was the worst president the typical sensible American citizen had ever seen. And they said anything but Carter. It was called ABC, anything but Carter. 1984, Mondale, he's a Carter man, anything but Carter. Re-elect Reagan, anything but Carter. Vote for Reagan, keep us out of the bushes. That was another phase. Then came 1989-1991. The Soviet system disintegrated politically and economically. And what happened is that people took the opportunity of the collapse of the Soviet system, no big rival, no challenge. The British monarchy, which is also the head of state of not only the United Kingdom, but Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and some other countries, of less significance, and the United States together, set up what was an intent to become, create an Anglo-American world empire, which later became known as globalization. The whole thing started with a program in 1989 that said we're not going to let Germany reunify. But Vernon Walters, who was then the U.S. ambassador to Germany, advised the Bush people, because it's hard to tell the difference sometimes, that this would be stupid. So they made a slightly different deal. And the policy was, it came down to, keep the Germans down and keep the Russians out. What result of this process was that Germany was reunified, but the East Germany section of the economy has been ruined. Yes, there is investment in infrastructure, the kind of thing you get around here that's going to collapse very soon. All these townhouses and McMansions and so forth, these things are about to go. They're about to be finished. Once this real estate bubble collapses, they're gone. Where the people are going to go, I don't know. But this real estate, this new economy, so-called consumer spending bubble, is about finished, along with the real estate bubble. Mass bankruptcies, not mass home ownership, is the word of the day. So they did it there, too. In the case of Russia, as in Africa, they said, loot the joint. Don't let them get up off the ground. Loot them into complete poverty. They'll never get off the ground. And so far they have not gotten off the ground. Steal their raw materials at bottom prices. Steal their scientists at bottom prices. Loot the joint. They went on to do other things. The Anglo-American Empire looted Africa. Look at George Bush's daddy, Barrick Gold, with private armies committing genocide in Congo to get a hold of that gold and other things that they're stealing out of there through Barrick Gold. It's a Canadian-U.S. operation. The former Prime Minister of Canada is involved in it. The same thing is done in Central and South America. Look in 1988, look at the number of countries which were freestanding, semi-independent at least, republics who thought they were independent, who had some power in 1988. How many of these countries of South and Central America have any independence today, any sovereignty? Mexico is looted by the United States for cheap labor. It depends upon its exports to the United States to survive. It was not allowed to develop internal resources to build up. That's been the trend in the United States' attitude toward Mexico since 1982.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of Lyndon LaRouche's September 1st speech from Reston, Virginia. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Lyndon LaRouche speaking on September 1st in Reston, Virginia.
Ecuador has been extinct as a nation state since dollarization. Peru has been taken over in a coup, a pro-drug runners coup, backed by the U.S. State Department of the U.S. government. Argentina is being destroyed. Uruguay, Paraguay, Bolivia, Colombia, all being destroyed. So where we had states, nation states, with governments, which you could argue with, deal with, in 1988, virtually Brazil is the only one really left standing today. And Mexico has a political character which keeps it alive as a state, but its economic situation is desperate. Africa, hopeless. So that's the kind of world we created. Now, the result of the thing is this. We've had empires in the past which, while rotting out at home, continued to revel in imperial glories because they were able to loot their subjects, like the ancient empires of Mesopotamia, or the ancient Roman Empire, or after the fall of Byzantium, Venice became the imperial maritime power ruling the Mediterranean and dominating all Europe and adjoining regions. And Venice continued to be that kind of power into modern times. Then the British and the Dutch were modeled by the Venetians on the Venetian model during the course of the 16th century and the 17th and 18th century. And they became maritime powers based on rentier financier interest, monarchies which were essentially bourgeois monarchies, that is, they were based on a rentier financier interest, not a productive interest, which engaged in maritime trade, that is, world maritime trade, such as the slave trade, for example, and used naval power to attempt to conquer and subjugate other nations and keep the system going, just the way Venice had done in its time. The United States and the British monarchy attempted to play that game from 1989 on. They looted the world. Now, the problem of that, as all empires of the past should have taught them that lesson, when you are destroyed, when you depend upon what you are extracting from your victims, your prey, as a predator, when you exhaust your prey on which you depend, you bring yourself down. And that is precisely it. Now, that's the system we have. The system is controlled by what is called in among the racists, the fascists, the other degenerates of the Supreme Court, stockholder interest or shareholder interest. The United States is not run by the interest of the general welfare. That's our constitutional principle, the general welfare. No government has the moral legitimacy to rule except as it is efficiently committed to promote the general welfare of not only all the living, but their posterity. That's the moral authority of a government, nothing else. Now these guys say, no, that is not allowed. That's what Scalia says, Antonin Scalia, and his sons, whatever they are sons of, I don't know, but his sons. He says that repeatedly. The law of the United States, of the majority of the Supreme Court, is called shareholder interest. Is based on John Locke, whose theories developed the Confederate Constitution and the Confederacy itself. That is what has taken over the United States. That's what the Congress stands for. That's what the present administration stands for, with its looting policies in health care, its looting policies in energy. Shareholder interest instead of the principle upon which the United States was founded, which was the general welfare. The improvement of the condition and productivity of labor of all of our people and their posterity. This was the thing we fought for in European civilization and finally got in one approximation in the 15th century. And then established as a force on this planet through the American Revolution, which is the first modern nation-state republic. If you look at Europe, you find no true nation-state republics. The governments of Europe, to the extent they are not fascist regimes or something, these governments were simply parliamentary reforms in which the state was controlled by a state interest and the parliament was a device to keep the people quiet and happy and to make a few minor reforms. But no government of Europe, parliamentary government of Europe, has the authority through a parliament to make any of the kinds of changes which are needed now to get the world out of this mess. Because the minute the parliament tried to do it, the parliament would be overthrown in a general election by a parliamentary system. Parliamentary system is the worst form of government you can imagine, because it pretends to be something good and it ain't. Though you may have some well-intentioned people in it, they are incapable of carrying out their intentions. So we are now ruled by laws, such as the HMO law, passed by the impetus of Pat Moynihan, a great Democrat, back in 1973, which overturned Hill Burton, which is killing people all over the United States today. He's a great humanist, you know. believes that the earth is overcrowded, so let's make everything nice for other people by killing as many as possible. So that was a great change. So we have two aspects. We have a world system which has broken with what used to make us powerful, what used to improve our conditions of life in many countries, to a system which is purely parasitical. I'll get to this a little more later. How do we used to survive? From the founding of this country, we fought for, against the British, at various points, especially from 1763 on. We fought to maintain the right of the Americans to have their own farming system, their own agricultural system, which was progressive, and their own industries, not to become dependents under a globalized system specified by the British monarchy at that time. That's been taken away. We no longer have our own industries. We have a few left. They say made in USA, but they're made in some by cheap labor some other part of the world. These markets are now collapsing. We've lost that. We used to be a society dependent upon scientific and technological progress and cultural progress. And we were pretty good at it, as nations go. We used to educate our young people for that kind of society. It is not a society where you do the same thing from generation to generation, but where today's generation will produce children who are better educated, who will go into schools, who will have better opportunities for work, and create a better condition of life in the society. That was our way. That's the way, what we believed in up until the middle of the 1960s, up until the Southern Strategy. That's what we believed in. That's what the Southerners hated, the Confederates. They hated it. It's what Kissinger hates. It's what his teacher, William Randolph Elliott, hates. What the Niceville Agrarians hate. So we changed in several respects. We changed in terms of economy from a productive economy to a predatory one, to an economy which was the keystone nation of a general economic recovery from depression and war into a piece of wreckage. A predator who is dying of the hunger created by its exhausting its prey. We destroyed our system of government. We destroyed the mission and conditions of life, especially the intellectual conditions of life of our own people. That's what I mean by a system. To define what we mean by a system and how to understand it, going back to this question of play, the term system in modern European usage comes out of classroom discussion of what we know as classroom Euclidean geometry. Now, classroom Euclidean geometry is not good, but it has a useful function in challenging the mind to know, discover what is wrong with Euclidean geometry. In other words, you don't become a scientist by becoming an exponent of Euclidean geometry. You become a scientist by discovering what is wrong, fatally wrong, and morally wrong with Euclidean geometry. Because what is Euclidean geometry? It's based on two things. First of all, it's based on certain assumptions, which are called definitions, axioms, and postulates. It says that nothing is true except as you can derive that conclusion from theorems from a deductive method applied to a system of definitions, axioms, and postulates. That's what you mean by a system. You mean some body of thought and practice, which is organized the way Euclidean geometry prescribes it. We use the term system to mean other kinds of systems besides the Euclidean system, including what might be called best anti-Euclidean systems. I am, for example, an exponent of an anti-Euclidean system in terms of my work on economics, in which my work coincides with the work of the famous 19th century scientist Bernard Riemann, which is an anti-Euclidean geometry. So what you're dealing with here is a system which, as a system, dooms us to go deeper and deeper into a pit with no solution. The way you get out of a mess with a bad system is you go into the definitions, the axioms and the postulates of the system, and you rip out the ones that are false. And instead, you put in place assumptions which are appropriate ones. Thus, you create a new system. In other words, the system is not the point of production. The system is not individual transactions. The system is not economy. The system lies in the superimposition on the activities of economy, the activities of life, of certain assumptions, such as shareholder value, such as free trade, such as globalization, and so forth, such as racism in all its disguises. These assumptions act like axioms. And as long as you either believe in these things or believe that you have to put up with your neighbor's democratic belief in this nonsense, then you are doomed to go down with the system, because the system is self-doomed. We are in a self-doomed system. Now, why are we in a self-doomed system? Why are we so stupid, we American people, that we put up with this nonsense? Well, there's a principle which comes from Rome. It's called vox populi, or popular opinion. Some people call it democracy. The worst form of corruption in the United States today is not fascism, it's democracy. Because democracy in most people's mind mean popular opinion. You vote for popular opinion. Popular opinion must control the legislature. Popular opinion must determine our laws. Popular opinion must determine how you behave. That's how we killed. How were we killed by that popular opinion? What did the Romans do? Who were the Romans? Why did they invent this thing? Well, Romans were not really a race or nation, not originally. The Romans were simply a group of Pat Robertson's type followers who a cult called the Cult of Delphi, the Cult of the Pythian Apollo, recruited among a Latin group, a speaking group of people in the middle of Italy. These guys who were recruited to this cult and were backed by this cult, sort of a Jim Jones operation, formed the city of Rome. Now, the city of Rome was based on a military system under which people from neighboring areas were slaughtered by military methods. And then the women were taken for breeding purposes with the Romans who had conquered them. And the children were made into that too, kept as breeding stock. So the population of Rome increased by this method of rape, murder, and breeding. Rape, essentially. They developed a system under which they distinguished between the two layers of the ruling layer, which they called the senators, and the others they called I populari. Now, I populari from the Latin signifies, in general, predator. In other words, it's just as if you want to set up a city in Washington, for example. You set up a city government in which a bunch of guys calling themselves senators took a bunch of people from the street as gangs, trained gangs, armed gangs, and turn them loose on the street the way some people are planning to do at the end of this month in Washington in the name of anti-globalization. A fourth generation of international terrorism be turned loose on the streets of Washington, D.C. That is what is called I populari, the predators. So all the honest people are terrified by these killers, these gang killers, and they now submit. And therefore, the question of the rulers is, how do they control I populari? How do they control the predators that they use for the killing? It's called popular opinion, vox populi. For predators, the voice of the predator, the howl of the hyena, vox populi. So, as was stated earlier, this Walter Lippmann on the doctrine of 1922 on public opinion. The trick is to use various devices to, in effect, brainwash the American people into becoming backers or recruiting them to a force of populari, predators, who will prey on their fellow man and work for the nations preying on other nations in order to maintain the rule of the few at top. It's the oligarchical system. How is it done to us? Well, What the result is this. You get people who call themselves, I have my own opinion. I'm an American. I follow the news. I read the newspapers. I know what's going on. I talk to people. I know what people are thinking. I know important people. I got secrets. You know, you would never guess. I got secrets. And this guy is running around saying, I know everything. He will read the Washington Post, which is like turning your mind into a sewer. And other things, the New York Times. It's different. They have, the New York Times is a sewer with spangles. The Boston Globe, which is a branch of the co-project of the Washington Post and the New York Times, and so forth and so on. The mass media in general, the entertainment media, worst of all, Hollywood, TV. This is the worst. Mass media, mass events, just as in ancient Rome, mass bodily contact sports, with people going into stadiums and tens and hundreds of thousands, obsessed with the events there, while a bunch of dummies beat the hell out of each other in the stadium. And you cheer like mad. And come out of there. That's my hero. That's my role model. A prostitute appears on a film. He's a leading star. That's my role model. I want to look just like her. I want to be just like her. This is an American popular opinion. The result is, as I've said repeatedly, and some people are shocked by it, the typical American, if all the oligarchs were to die, if all the lackeys of the oligarchs were to die, most American people would be like the slaves who put the shackles on their own ankles and hands every morning and every night, even when the master's there, no longer there to tell them to do so. They have become the self-imprisoned. They're like a bunch of prisoners. For example, the concentration camps, all the Nazis were like that. The Nazi guards generally did not go inside the camps. They used certain prisoners, often from the criminal class, the felon type, the physical felon type. And they would use these guys as hit squads, and they would send them on assignments inside the camps to do the killing. This is the way it was working in the 1930s and on. People like Buchenwald, Dachau, and so forth. That's what was going on. The Nazi guards did not go down to the camp unless they went in with a very special operation, very carefully prepared, to defend themselves, to handle the situation with shock methods. And that's the way often politics works in the United States. You think of your neighbor as a rat. You think of members of your own family as rats. Because these are the people that are going to gang up on you, like the special squads inside, among the prisoners inside the concentration camp, to kill you or ruin you in some other way, if you get out of line. So we become a self-policed prison house, in the same way that the Roman rulers used e populari and popular opinion to turn the Roman population into a self-destructive force, which resulted in one of the greatest dark ages in known civilization. Not as a result of the rulers, not as a result of Nero or Caligula or even Diocletian. The destruction occurred because of the Roman people themselves. And the destruction which occurs in European civilization since, whether in Europe or the United States or Central and South America, is romanticism. Romanticism means specifically this kind of opinion. The tradition of culture, the condition of artistic taste, the tradition of ideas, the tradition of social relations, adapted from the Roman Empire. For example, the first modern fascist was Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon Bonaparte was created by a mob run from London of the type that they planned to put on the streets of Washington, D.C. from the environs at the end of this month. They were called the Jacobin Terror, which was launched on July 14th, 1789, which the French celebrate as a holiday. A fascist coup is celebrated as the official holiday of France, national holiday. They remained in power until Robespierre was beheaded 5 years later. Then France was so destroyed morally from within by this process that a fascist came to power. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte. He declared himself Caesar, crowned himself the Emperor Caesar of France, imposed on France a legal code called the Code Napoleon, which is derived from the Latin code, Roman code. And then you had, after that, you had the Restoration Monarchy in France, which was a British puppet monarchy. Then you had Napoleon III, who was a fascist. Then you had models like that, such as Hitler, Mussolini, Hitler in this century, and Franco and so forth. This is an example. Modern fascism is a logical outgrowth of Romanticism, of the type that dominates much of the culture of the United States today. So that's the system. That's what makes us prisoners. The way to deal with this problem, again, we have to come back and start playing again. Have fun. The remedy for every crisis, every emotional crisis, have fun. Don't get ugly, have fun. The difference between man and beast is the basis of all civilized life. What's the difference between a human being and an animal? Some people think there's no difference. There was even a cartoon I saw in the Washington Post today about George Bush, President George Bush, saying that he didn't think that the contamination of stem cells with mouse stem cells was going to create a problem. And they have him as president standing there speaking. He's president with mouse ears sticking out. And this is typical of the problem. What's the difference between man and animal? There is a difference. It's a difference we can demonstrate. It's a difference called cognition. Only a human being can make an original, valid discovery of a universal physical principle. No animal can do it. Only a human being. Only a human being can cause another human being to replicate exactly that experience of discovery. No animal can do it. That's why animals have fixed cultures, because they're incapable of developing a culture. They cannot discover universal physical principles by means of which they increase their species' power to exist in the universe. Only human beings can do that. Now, if your relationship to other human beings is cognitive, in other words, instead of reading a book or having your hind end plugged into electric wires to the internet or something like that, if you are educated by re-experiencing as much as possible the great discoveries actually made by the greatest minds before you for thousands of years past, and if the memory of that act of discovery is living again today in your mind, you are human. You're human in a functional sense, because when you look at the eyes of some other person, what you see is not the physical image of this human body. What you see is the function of that mind, that behind those eyes, on the other side of the room, there is a cognitive being who is capable of incorporating and generating great fundamental discoveries of universal physical principle. Okay? If you say, as Kant did, or as Locke did, or as Adam Smith did, as the empiricists and positivists do, as a stem cell embryo freaks do, if you say that man is only another animal, that there is no process of cognition, there's no power of discovery of universal physical principles, no power of discovery of classical artistic principles. It's all just a matter of opinion. If you say that, you're nothing but an animal. Not because you were born to be an animal, but because you're thinking like an animal. You're behaving like an animal, not a human being. You're incapable of loving other human beings as human beings. I think the record of marriage these days attests to the degeneration of morality on that account. People say, why'd you get a divorce? I got tired. I wasn't exciting anymore. I wanted a new experience. Not fashionable. I changed the type I like. I saw a new movie star. And this is what people do these days. They have become bestialized, who do not see that all beauty, all human beauty, lies in this quality of mind. Isn't it the most wonderful thing in the world, from a standpoint of understanding history, to re-experience in your own mind the actual act of discovery of a great principle made by a great thinker from the past?
You've been listening to EIR Talks, presenting excerpts from Lyndon LaRouche, speaking to an international audience on the need for new, serious leadership in the United States. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference at which he spoke, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.